This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Datuk Muhammad Hishamuddin Muhammad Yunus is a former Court of Appeal judge who spent almost 23 years in the Malaysian judiciary. Born in 1949 in the small town of Johor, Negeri Sembilan, Datuk Hishamuddin was educated at Malay College Kuala Kangsar and obtained his law degree from the London School of Economics. He entered the legal and judicial services as a magistrate in 1973, rose through the ranks, and was appointed judge of the Court of Appeal in 2009. Upon reaching the mandatory retirement age of 66 last September, Professor Shad Salim Farooqi wrote that his integrity, fearless independence and unwavering commitment to constitutional supremacy will be remembered. I'm speaking to him today about his more than four-decade-long career in law. Welcome to the show, Datuk. Tell us a little bit about your background. What was your childhood and, you know, younger days like?
Well, I was born in a small town of Johor in the state of Negeri Sembilan. My father works in the Marine Railway, first as a station master and then as a traffic controller. My mother is a housewife, and I remember we moved house quite often. I remember my father was posted in Kerdau, Pahang, in Bangi, in Air Kuning, but I spent a large part of my childhood in the railway town of Kemas. I had my primary education there at Tuanku Abdul Rahman School. And for my secondary education, I was enrolled at the Malay College Kuala Kangsar from Form 1 right until Upper 6. Then I went over to London to do my law degree.
Were you always very good at studies?
I could say I'm an average student.
Okay.
Yes.
And what was it that led you to do law when you hit university?
It's very difficult to me why I was interested in law. But the fact that my late grandfather was a magistrate, I think indirectly has an influence on me. It does, I think, arouse my interest to study law.
There is a saying that lawyers are born either as prosecutors or defenders. Where do you fall in this debate? Do you believe that to be true?
I don't believe that to be true. I think there are other fields, the legal aspect of the legal profession. I think I spend a large portion of my career not either as a defender or prosecutor, but more as a legal draftsman and also as a legal advisor to the government. And I was also for a short stint, a magistrate and a court registrar.
Looking back at all those varied roles and at your life within the judicial system, what was the most challenging period in your career?
I think compared to being in the judicial legal service and compared to being on the bench, I would think this more challenging when you are in the judicial and legal service. When you are a legal advisor to the government, be it a federal government or the state government. Yes, I was for 2.5 years the state legal advisor of Selangor, or as boundary draftsman, where you spend your time day in, day out, drafting laws for the country.
Going into some of your rulings as a judge, you've said that the ruling you wrote for the case on transgender rights was your best. Could you explain for us why?
It is an interesting case because it involves many issues. Human rights, or you can call it fundamental rights. It involves religious issues, it involves medical issue, and also it involves a sociological issue.
In the ruling, you cited a statement by Aston Paiva, the appellant's lawyer, that the Constitution exists precisely so that the minority cannot be subject to the tyranny of the majority. Could you elaborate on that statement?
In fact, the Constitution is meant to protect all, regardless of whether you are minority or the majority. But it is the minority that depends more on the Constitution rather than the majority. Because the majority would have their representation in parliament and having the majority members of parliament can make laws to safeguard the majority. But then what about the minority? So when they feel that their fundamental rights are being deprived of, then it is to the constitution they look to, and it is to the courts they look to for help.
The decision we're talking about was unanimous. Sitting alongside you on the panel was Justice Azia Ali and Justice Lim Yi Lan. Could you give us a glimpse into how decisions are made when there are three of you?
The judgment can be made either there's one judgment or there could be separate judgments. Normally, in the day-to-day cases, there'll be only one judgment. Unless it is not a unanimous judgment, but there's a dissenting judgment, then you have a judge writing the majority judgment and the dissenting judge writing his dissenting judgment. But in very important cases involving the Constitution, cases involving a public interest, normally the panel will write separate judgments. But in this case, it's only one judgment. After hearing the case and it's time to write the judgment, I did invite the other two members of the panel, Justice Azia and Justice Lim Yi Lan, that we write, each of us write a separate judgments. However, Justice Azia and Justice Lim Yi Lan also the view that I write the first draft first and then pass it to them for their construction. So that's what I did. I wrote the judgment first, distributed it to them, and the feedback I got from them is that they agree. So that's why we end up with just one judgment, although it is a very important constitutional law case.
The Supreme Court case of Che Omar Che So in 1988 was a landmark ruling which said that all laws, whether federal or state, Sharia or civil, must be in line with the federal constitution. How influential overall are precedents in Malaysian law?
We go by the doctrine of precedent. That means the decision of a higher court binds the lower court. And as far as the decision of courts of coordinate jurisdiction, the courts will, as far as possible, try to follow that decision so that there will be certainty in the law. That's why the principle of binding precedent, as you call it, is very important.
And what about the role of foreign law?
Where it involves an issue and there's not much or there's hardly any precedent on the matter, normally the courts will look to judgment of foreign courts for guidance. But judgment of foreign courts are persuasive in nature and not binding.
I'm speaking today with Datuk Muhammad Hishamuddin Muhammad Yunus, retired Court of Appeal judge, and we've been discussing his life and career in law. Up next, we find out what it means to say that a judge must not stick to the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Datuk Muhammad Hishamuddin Muhammad Yunus, retired Court of Appeal judge. We're talking about his life and career in law. Professor Shad Faruqi noted your judicial activism and creative interpretation. Both are terms that to different people, you know, to certain people could have potential negative connotations. What do they mean to you?
I think judicial activism is very important. And judges sometimes won't admit that they practice judicial activism, but in reality, they do practice judicial activism. And in fact, the common law developed in England through judicial activism. Judicial activism is where the court pronounces a judgment not based on the strict letter of the law, but taking into account the whole circumstance of the case, the condition, the current condition of the time, and taking into account broad principle of justice. Judicial activism is where the court play an innovative and a creative role to develop the law in a positive sense,
And when we talk about, you know, trying to apply the spirit of the law, trying to understand where it comes from and how it applies, can you give us some examples of how this principle has worked out in some cases that you've adjudicated?
Right. When we talk about the spirit of the law, we are focusing on the purpose of the law. We don't interpret the law in a literal sense. An example would be Article 12. Clause 4 of the Federal Constitution, where it says the religion of a child shall be determined by his or her parent. The word there is singular, parent, and not parents. So if we were to take a literal sense, it means it can be determined either by the father without the participation of the mother, or by the mother without the participation of the father. But that is taking the law in its literal sense. If we were to take the spirit of the law, then the religion of a minor, of a child, cannot be determined by just one parent. It must be determined by both parents. That's what I mean in accordance with the spirit of the law.
When we talk to members of the legal fraternity here in the country, one theme that tends to recur is this idea that some of our laws are outdated or archaic in some senses. Would you agree with that statement?
Sure, I certainly agree. And take, for example, the Sedition Act. Yes, that is a law that we inherit from British times. And I think it is it should be considered obsolete under present circumstances, because, you know, it is inconsistent with freedom of speech. And another problem is, what is seditious or not is something that's not very clear. So everyone who utters something, especially when he criticizes the government, he finds himself in a precarious position. And we inherit from British times, and even England has done away with the Sedition Act. So I think it's high time that we should also do away with the Sedition Act. But there are certain sections in the Sedition Act that we can retain, you know, that one that prohibits the utterance of sensitive matters, questioning the position of Islam, questioning the interests of other communities, questioning the national language, questioning the position of rulers. But that can be taken out, and those prohibitions can still be maintained, but not under a law called Sedition Act. It could be maintained under another law, which perhaps you can call it the National Harmony Act. Right.
How much work would it take to do that kind of rearranging and refiguring, you know, to take an existing act and kind of repackage it?
Well, it will take time, because the Sedition Act is just one example. We might have to consider other law as well. For example, is the death penalty is still relevant today? Right? But I think one way of doing it is to have what we call a law reform commission, to study all the acts in this country and see what needs to be repealed or amended, and to advise the government accordingly.
We mentioned at the start, you know, you entered the legal and judicial services in 1973. How much has the legal landscape in Malaysia changed since that time?
A lot. I remember I was a magistrate. We have a shortage of courtrooms. I had to share chambers. And those days, the courtrooms were old. But today, we have all new buildings, and practically all chambers and courtrooms are air-conned. And those days, we have to record the evidence ourselves, writing longhand every word that the witness utters or every word that the lawyers submitted. But today, all are recorded, and the notes are no longer prepared by the minister or the judge, but the notes are prepared by the court transcribers.
And for the uninitiated, could you describe the circumstances of the judicial crisis in 1988 and the effect it had at the time?
Well, what happened in 1988 was that three judges were dismissed And one of them was the Lord President then, and three judges were suspended. The three judges who were suspended were later found to be innocent and reinstated. But personally, I find that the charges against them were, I would say, flimsy or weak charges. They shouldn't have been charged in the first place. The dismissal and suspension were unjust and should have taken place in the first place. What happened was, a number of years later, in the year 2008, when Tun Abdullah Ahmad Badawi became the Prime Minister and Datuk Zaid Ibrahim became the Law Minister, the government acknowledged that the judges had been wronged and compensation were paid to them. But it has the episode of 1988, judicial assault in 1988, had a negative impact. It had a big dent, not only on the image of the judiciary, but also on the image of the government. And I think the court is still trying to recover from the effect of that.
Could you also tell us about the case of Public Prosecutor versus Kok Wah Kwan in 2007 and how it led to the federal court declaring that the doctrine of separation of powers does not exist in our constitution?
It is a child offender, or rather a minor who was convicted, if I'm not mistaken, of murder. And when it comes to the sentencing, he was sentenced to, because it's the law then, I think it's still the law, to be detained at the pleasure of the ruler. So the minor, through his lawyer, raised the issue that law could not be constitutional because the sentencing of a person must be done by the judiciary and not by the executive. Somehow, from that issue, it goes into the question of judicial power and of the judiciary and the separation of powers. The majority of the federal court took the position that the judicial amendment to Article 121, effected in 1988, takes away judicial power of judiciary, and the power of judiciary to educate on the laws is only to the extent that was conferred by Parliament. And the other position taken by the federal court is that the doctrine of the separation of powers is not part of our constitution. But we have a dissenting judgment in that case. That is a dissenting judgment of Justice Richard Malanjun, to the effect that, notwithstanding the constitutional amendment, we still have the doctrine of separation of powers in the constitution, and the amendment does not affect the judicial power of judiciary. In my view, I am with the dissenting judgment of Justice Richard Malanjun.
Looking at where we are right now, is there a growing tension between the civil and Sharia court's jurisdiction?
It appears to be so from recent developments, but my view is that there's nothing wrong with the law. The law is there. But the problem is how the civil court interpret the law. The law is very clear that the Sharia court has no jurisdiction when it involves interpretation of the constitution or where one of the parties to the dispute is a non-Muslim. But the problem is when matters of this nature come before the civil court, instead of seizing jurisdiction and decide on the issue, to rule that, oh, it involves a non-Muslim. So instead of adopting such a position, they make a ruling that the matter should go to the Sharia court. Yeah. So how could the Sharia court decide on a constitutional issue? Okay? Or how could the Sharia court decide on a dispute where one of the parties is a non-Muslim? So herein lies a problem.
In your opinion, should non-Muslims be allowed to practice Sharia law?
In my opinion, if a non-Muslim satisfies the legal requirements, he has passed all the exams, and he proves to be knowledgeable in Sharia law, in my opinion, I don't see why he or she can't practice in the Sharia court.
You've also said that the level of advocacy in the Court of Appeal is not at the standard it should be. How so? What did you mean?
It's based on my experience, yeah. Because at the Court of Appeal level, I would expect a higher standard of advocacy. But I must say, the senior lawyers do show a high level of advocacy, the senior lawyers. But then, many of the lawyers that come before the Court of Appeal are relatively junior lawyers. So that's a problem here. Yeah.
On that note about junior lawyers, you've also called for a law academy to improve lawyers' courtroom skills. What do you think is missing from today's legal education and training compared to what you had in your time?
Well, my time, there is hardly any training at all. I came back from London with my law degree and with my barrister law degree. And 3 weeks later, I was asked to sit as a magistrate at the Court Helier. There was no ILCAP then. There is no induction courses. So we just had to learn through observing how the seniors do their job and through experience. But today, as far as the government service is concerned, there is ILCAP and fresh intakes to become magistrates or to become federal counsel. They are sent to ILCAP for induction courses. But putting that aside, I would prefer that those in the private sector, before they could become advocates in the court, that they should undergo a training, perhaps a one-year training at the academy, where they will be taught under an intensive programs the art of advocacy.
Moving on, what's next for you now that you've retired from the bench?
I am at the moment a consultant with a legal firm, and I intend to do a little bit of arbitration.
And do you read for fun? What do you like to read?
I love reading, and the subject matter that I love to read would be something to do with the law, like legal history, legal literature. I also like to read on comparative religions, on politics, just things like that. Yeah.
And finally, what advice do you have for those who are aspiring to a career in law?
Well, read a lot. Having a law degree is insufficient. The learning process begins the moment you start your career. And never be disheartened if in the initial stages you lose your cases. It takes time to be a good lawyer, and it takes a lot of experience.
Thank you very much, Dato. I've been speaking with Dato Muhammad Hishamuddin Muhammad Yunus, retired Court of Appeal judge. Together we've been discussing his life in law. You've been listening to Live and Learn today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.